Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 17th of April, these are our main stories. The UN says Israel is continuing to impose unlawful restrictions on aid to Gaza and calls on it to do more to stop the escalating violence in the West Bank. Belgium's Prime Minister has criticised the decision to shut down a meeting in Brussels of hard-right politicians from across Europe. A bill banning anyone who's currently 15 or younger from ever buying cigarettes has cleared its first major hurdle in the British Parliament. Also in this podcast...
So given the chance, this black hole will certainly suck in any material that it can get. But at the minute, it's not doing that, so it isn't active. And that's why we can't see this black hole directly.
Astronomers have made a surprising discovery. A black hole, not that far from planet Earth, just a mere 2,000 light years away. Until Iran's attack on it last weekend, Israel had been facing increased international pressure to allow more food, medicine and other vital supplies into Gaza. Now, despite its claims that it is allowing more aid convoys in after repeated warnings about a looming famine, the UN says Israel is still preventing urgently needed aid from getting into the besieged Palestinian territory. The UN human rights spokesperson is Ravina Shamdasani.
Israel continues to impose unlawful restrictions on the entry and distribution of humanitarian assistance, carry out widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure as well. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights repeats that there must be an immediate ceasefire, the hostages must be released, and full unfettered humanitarian aid must be allowed to flow immediately. Those delivering or trying to access humanitarian assistance must never be attacked.
James Landell in Jerusalem told us more about the UN's accusations.
This, despite the fact that the Israelis have made it very, very clear in all their public utterances that they are doing more to get aid in. They said this specifically after the killing of the aid workers a while back. They promised to open up new crossings. They promised to open up the port of Ashdod to get more aid flowing through the north. Now, if you talk to NGOs and aid workers on the ground, they say that there is an improvement, but it's very modest and it's very moderate. And the UN says that it's still having trouble getting access to what they need.
And the situation in Gaza has been overshadowed by this weekend's unprecedented attack by Iran on Israel. What's the latest on how Israel is planning to respond to that?
They're still considering their options. They say there will be a response. But two things today gave us a suggestion, an indication that maybe Israel is thinking of playing this longer than expected and that there might not be an imminent response. The first thing was an opinion poll that suggested that Israeli public opinion is very divided over how and when Israel should respond. Almost 50-50, it was actually 52-48 in favour of some kind of response and some saying there shouldn't be any response at all. And of those who said, you know, there should be a military response, about 30% of the country said there should not be a military response, and then another 30% said they just simply didn't know. So that was the first indication, and that was from, you know, a respected pollster for a respected university here in Jerusalem. The other signal we got today was from senior Israeli policymakers, Benny Gantz, a member of the War Cabinet, and also the main spokesman for the army, both of whom spoke about the need for there to continue to be an alliance against Iran. In other words, they were arguing that Iran was not just the enemy of Israel, but the enemy of the region, of the world. And their argument was that the world should stay united with Israel against Iran. In other words, the suggestion that if and when there is any response to the attack, it would be more coordinated. It would be an act of retaliation that kept those allies on side. And if that is the thinking, then the implication is that Israel will think long and hard and be very calibrated about its response to try and keep that alliance together. In other words, operationalizing the sympathy that it got as a result of the weekend's attack.
James Landell. Well, the UN Human Rights Office has also voiced grave concerns about the escalating violence in the occupied West Bank. Hundreds of Jewish settlers torched Palestinian homes in the West Bank over the weekend, killing two people after the murder of an Israeli teenager. The UN has accused Israeli security forces of active participation in attacks on Palestinians by Jewish settlers. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Beshega.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers, armed with guns and stones, stormed the village of Mukhayr near Ramallah. Houses and cars are set alight, and a group of men target Jihad Abu Aliya's house. He tries to stop the attack, but is killed with a shot in the chest. He was 25 and planning to get married in June. This is his cousin, Samir.
Jihad was trying to prevent the settlers from breaking the house door of Samir's house, where dozens of the town residents arrived in the home to prevent them from burning the house. It wasn't the first time settlers attacked us, but we weren't expecting a huge number of them. They shot at the water tanks, the electricity network, and the internet. They were planning to isolate us from the outside world.
The attack on Saturday was part of a rampage by Israeli settlers across the West Bank. The violence was sparked by the disappearance of a 14-year-old Israeli teenager, Binyamin Ahimer. He went missing on Friday after leaving his Israeli outpost. A day later, he was found dead. In the village of Da'id Dibwan, also near Ramallah, CCTV captured a settler setting fire on a car under the watch of at least three Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military said it was investigating the incident. Ziv Stahl is the director of Yesh Din, an Israeli human rights group.
What we see with the military is basically not fulfilling their duty to protect Palestinians in the West Bank. We see them escort the violent settlers, providing them with protection.
Tensions in the West Bank have escalated since the start of the war in Gaza, amid rising raids by the Israeli army and violence by Israeli settlers. Activists say these attacks and the involvement of the Israeli security forces are rarely investigated, with impunity virtually the norm.
Hugo Beshega. Belgium's Prime Minister has criticised a decision by a local mayor in Brussels to shut down a controversial gathering of hard-right politicians. Alexander De Croo said banning political meetings was unconstitutional and unacceptable. Police stopped people from entering the venue where the meeting was taking place, but refrained from forcing those who were already there to leave. France's far-right former presidential contender, Eric Zemmour, was one of those not allowed to enter. But another attendee, the British Brexiteer, Nigel Farage, did manage to go ahead with his speech. A former British Interior Minister, Suella Braverman, also took part. And Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, was scheduled to speak too. This all comes as far-right politicians across Europe are expected to do well in EU elections due to be held in June. From Brussels, our Europe correspondent Nick Beek sent this report.
A clash of ideologies played out on the streets of Brussels. A movement that wants to go global collided with very local politics. To this national conservatism event came a Belgian policeman, armed with a decree from the local socialist mayor, instructing the right-wing delegates from across Europe and the US to leave. The speeches had already got underway, with promises being made to revive traditional beliefs and reassert the nation-state.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Top of the bill was the former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman. But local officials had decided the views of these speakers could spark public disorder, and so ordered the event to stop. Nigel Farage was among those condemning the decision.
It's monstrous. Absolutely monstrous. You know, a very decent, respectable group of people, members of the European royal family, prime ministers, academics, business people, being told they can't have an alternative view. Thank God for Brexit.
Well, can I just ask, the local mayor says it's because of fears over anti-abortion, possibly anti-gay sentiments held by people in the building.
Cobblers.
Whether it was suppression of free speech or protecting the public from extremist ideology, the police found a compromise of sorts. They refused to let any more people into the conference, but did not drag out those already inside. The ban did mean the far-right French politician, Eric Zemmour, was unable to give his speech. The spectacle catapulted a gathering of only a few hundred people onto the front pages of news websites. As one organiser put it, you can't buy publicity like this.
Nick Beek. Police in India say a top Maoist leader was among at least 29 rebels killed during a major gun battle with security forces. The shootout in the central state of Chhattisgarh comes just days before the start of India's general election. Here's Electra Naismith.
This is possibly one of the biggest insurgent operations carried out in Chhattisgarh and will be seen as a huge success for security forces, not least because among those killed is Shankar Rao, a top rebel commander with a bounty on his head. The gun battle in what's known as the Red Corridor followed a tip-off that senior Maoist leaders were in the area. Police say they've recovered a significant amount of ammunition. The far-left radicals have been battling for decades for the rights of the rural poor. Narendra Modi's BJP is campaigning in part on a pledge to eliminate them.
Electra Naismith. Astronomers have made a surprising discovery. A black hole not that far from us, just a mere 2,000 or so light years away. It's what's known as a stellar black hole that's nothing like as large as a supermassive variety at the centre of our galaxy. This is a much smaller category of black hole. It comes from a star that is expiring. But this one still has 33 times the mass of the Sun, so much bigger than your average stellar black hole. But is it close enough to suck our planet into it? Evan Davis spoke to Dr. Jenny Millard, an astronomer at Cardiff University and presenter of the Awesome Astronomy podcast.
The problem is with black holes, we can't see them directly. So there's a couple of ways we find them. One is if they've got a disk of gas going around them, it becomes superheated and then that emits light. And so then we can infer the presence of the black hole. And the other way is the impact it can have on a companion star. And that's how we found this one. So Gaia is a survey telescope and it's mapping the position and motions of billions of stars in our galaxy. And one of the stars in the constellation of Aquila the Eagle, well, it saw this star wobbling unexpectedly. And so from that wobbling, we can infer the presence of this 33 sun's mass black hole, because this black hole is tugging on its companion star as they orbit each other, dancing through space.
Yeah, so what's the companion star thing? Not every black hole has a companion star, does it? Or is that a thing?
Yeah, not every black hole has a companion star. And if they don't have a companion, it makes them even more difficult to detect, you know, unless they've got that disk of gas and dust around them that's glowing. So by having this companion and it interacting with this companion, that's how we've been able to discover this 33 suns worth black hole.
Now, is it still sucking everything around it in? We have this vision of black holes as a kind of vacuum that sort of pull everything in around them. Is it still? And is it ever possible that, you know, we come close enough to one of these things that they actually affect our little solar system?
So given the chance, this black hole will certainly suck in any material that it can get. But at the minute, it's not doing that. So it isn't active. And that's why we can't see this black hole directly. But in terms of our safety, we haven't got anything to worry about when it comes to this black hole, because it's 2,000 light years away. And 2,000 light years away is well beyond the constraints of our solar system. There are many, many thousands of stars in between us and this black hole. It's just on the scale of our galaxy, which is about 100,000 light years across. Well, that's relatively close. It's basically in our cosmic backyard, but it poses no threat to us.
Astronomer Dr. Jenny Millard. Still to come.
The culture, the food, the kindness of the people, it's completely different than anything that I've experienced in the States.
Why Colombia, once riven by internal armed conflict, is now becoming a top destination for digital nomads. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The International Monetary Fund says it expects much stronger growth in the United States this year than previously predicted. It now forecasts growth of 2.7%, more than double the rate of any other G7 economy. And the global economy is now expected to expand by 3.2%, higher than previously estimated. But the IMF warns central banks against cutting interest rates too quickly, fearing a return of high inflation. Ed Butler spoke to Mohamed El Erian, former deputy director of the IMF and president of Queen's College, Cambridge. So is this forecast by the IMF good news or a mixed picture?
It is a positive take, and it's associated with what the IMF characterizes as surprising resilience for the global economy. Having said that, they stress that we are likely to see more divergent outcomes. And the underlying theme is one of the multiple transitions that different countries are going to be able to handle differently.
Yeah, I mean, that means the US is doing pretty well, India's doing pretty well, but lots of other places aren't.
Correct. And they express concerns that not only is the average growth rate of these other places low, but their fiscal buffers, the ability to absorb any shocks, has been run down. And they have this notion that we live in a more shock-prone world.
Can we just look at inflation first of all? Because, of course, so much of the global conversation has been around inflation and interest rates over the last couple of years. What is their take on that? I mean, what are we expecting over the next few months?
So their take is that inflation has come down faster than expected. However, they are starting to recognize what others have recognized, which is labeled as a difficulty of the last mile. The notion that inflation has now gotten to the stage where it is more sticky and is going to be harder to bring down to central banks' 2% inflation target. What they don't take up, and I understand why diplomatically they haven't, is the key question, is 2% the right inflation target?
Yeah, because it's kind of arbitrary one, isn't it? We've talked about this before. It was set ages ago as somehow notionally the best number for inflation. But many people think, you know, why two? Why not 2.5? Why not 3?
Correct. It was set in the early 1990s by New Zealand. And it was an experiment in what was called inflation targeting. The experiment worked well, so it was adopted by other countries with very different attributes. You know, it is strange that countries that differ in the structure have the same inflation target. We're talking here of the US, of the Eurozone, of the UK, of New Zealand, of Australia. But it became this arbitrary number, and it didn't matter because the world was experiencing so many positive supply shocks that inflation wasn't a problem. But now that inflation has become a problem and we've been above target consistently, we should be asking the question, is that the right target in a world which is becoming more inflexible on the supply side and where fragmentation has replaced globalization?
Okay, well, so central banks are going to take different views on what the right level is, or at least where to set their interest rates to bring inflation down. I guess they're all still notionally at least targeting the 2% figure. But what should we be looking out for in terms of the risks? I mean, obviously, this is just a forecast. Forecasts can be wrong, and there's always geopolitical hazards on the horizon, aren't there?
Correct. You know, the IMF has moved to a balanced risk scenario. So thinking that the risks out there are balanced. I think if they knew then what they know now about the geopolitics, I suspect that the balance of risk would not have been balanced, would have been to the negative side.
You mean war escalation in the Middle East, for instance?
More escalation, oil prices going higher, that having a stagflationary impact, meaning it will undermine growth and push up inflation.
Mohamed El Erian, former deputy director of the IMF. Colombia, a country once shunned by foreign visitors because of a decades-long internal armed conflict, has become a top destination for digital nomads since the pandemic. It's brought a welcome financial boost to some locals, but others say they're being priced out. Catherine Ellis reports.
Colombia, a country full of music, biodiversity, coffee, and increasingly digital nomads. The country has recently soared in popularity with remote workers from around the world, wanting to enjoy a different way of life while not giving up their incomes. Eleanor Hughes from New Zealand is one of them.
I wanted to come here and dance more salsa here and just happened to be able to do that with my job.
Brianne Rout, who works for a US ceramics company in New Orleans, says there are many things that attracted her to Colombia.
The culture, the food, the kindness of the people, it's completely different than anything that I've experienced in the States.
Colombia's second biggest city, Medellin, with its leafy suburbs, cable cars, and relatively low cost of living, once dubbed the murder capital of the world in the early 90s, and associated with narcotics trafficking and the infamous drug lord Pablo Escobar, has undergone a momentous transformation. Fruit seller Carlos Acosta says more foreigners means more business.
Some of them are great customers, good people who buy a lot. Things have improved a little with these people.
One study by consultancy firm Breakthrough estimates around 8,300 digital nomads are arriving in Medellin each month, helped in part by a renewable two-year digital nomad visa introduced in 2022. Uber driver Henri Muriel says he's benefited hugely.
They make up 70% of business for me, these people from abroad. Their arrival is good because if more arrive, the economy is better.
But some landlords now prefer to rent to foreigners who are willing to pay more than locals, pushing up prices in some areas by as much as 80%.
When digital nomads start to come in, the market starts to be more constrained.
Juan Guillermo Yunda is a professor in urban and regional planning at Colombia's Pontifical Javerian University. He says that in Medellin, we're seeing a distinct type of gentrification.
More a super gentrification that is not displacing the lower-income population, as happens in cities in the United States and Europe, but is displacing more kind of middle-upper-income families that traditionally used to live in these areas.
Cristina Guerrero has been looking for a new home for weeks without any luck.
The rent here in Medellin has increased exponentially. Sometimes there are apartments that you see and say, no, this isn't worth that much.
Despite rising rents, Medellin and Colombia has gone from no-go zone to one of the most desirable digital nomad destinations in the world, drawing in people like Brianne Rout.
I am absolutely in love with the mountains, the beaches, the hot, the cold. It has absolutely everything to offer.
Brianne says she's not planning on leaving anytime soon, and given the digital nomad visa is renewable, she might not have to.
That report by Catherine Ellis. A fierce regional storm that's killed 18 people has caused chaos at Dubai Airport, the world's second busiest. An airport spokesman said all incoming flights on Tuesday evening were being diverted due to widespread flooding. Here's our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
The Gulf region, usually known for its hot and arid climate, has been lashed by high winds and torrential rains. The storm first passed over Oman, where floods cut off roads and swept away cars, killing 18 people, many of them children. Bahrain was also hit, and some inland areas of the UAE saw nearly 80% of an average year's rainfall in just 24 hours. Roads around Dubai Airport remain flooded, with arriving passengers advised to use public transport and incoming flights diverted.
Mike Thompson. British members of Parliament have overwhelmingly backed plans to ban anyone born after 2009 from ever buying cigarettes. The proposals are among the strictest anti-smoking measures in the world. They also include restrictions designed to make vapes less appealing to children. The bill was championed by the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, but his predecessor, Liz Truss, was among more than 60 members of Parliament who voted against it, arguing the law would limit personal freedom.
And my real fear is that this is not the final stage that the health police want to push. They are the health police. They are the health police, and people are concerned about this. They want to be able to make their own decisions about what they eat, what they drink, and how they enjoy themselves.
Our UK political affairs correspondent is Rob Watson. He told Tim Franks more about this groundbreaking legislation.
You've got two stories here, Tim. You've got a domestic British political story, which we'll come on to in a second. But actually, I think probably more enduring will be the global health story. And one suspects that long after Rishi Sunak has gone, what Britain is doing here with this law, which is being very closely watched around the world, it will be what will endure, because essentially Britain is instigating a plan to try and make the country smoke-free that, if you like, is more radical than anything that's being tried anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, and I mean, the advocates of this measure are saying, I mean, look, the point is here, it's not really about choice because smoking is an addiction, but also there are no safe levels of smoking.
Yes, I mean, the advocates are saying exactly that, that it's not choice if you've become addicted at an early age and you're just so desperate to stop it. And they're also making, a sort of logistical argument, which is that in Britain, smoking causes the largest number of preventable deaths, 80,000 a year, and that it's also immensely costly, costing over $20 billion. So they're saying it's a sort of a no-brainer in practical terms and that you're going to have to get there one way or another.
Tell us about the politics of this vote then, Rob.
As I say, I do think, Tim, that the kind of global health issue will be what resonates long beyond Mr. Sunak leaving office. But absolutely, there is, of course, this issue within the governing Conservative Party where you've, I'm not going to call them a libertarian rump, because there's obviously quite a lot of them, something like nearly 60 voted against it, who just think, look, it's not up to the state to be telling people how to live their lives. And even though many of them argued smoking is, we don't want to see young people smoking, but where will it end? I mean, will the state start telling people how much alcohol they could drink, how many carrots they should eat, how many vegetables they should have? And so that was argued very, very powerfully, as alongside the other objection to it, which is that, you know, how practical would it be? I mean, how are you going to distinguish in 20 years' time from someone who was born in 2008 and 2009? But again, the polling here suggests that the vast majority of voters are in favour of this, including, interestingly, Conservative voters, people who voted Conservative in 2019. So, you know, the idea that there's a sort of a libertarian base of voters that the Conservatives can tap into, I mean, the evidence suggests that it isn't there. But I guess, you know, once again, it's a reminder of the dramas within the governing Conservative Party. Although, again, I get the sort of sense, Tim, that outside of Westminster, an awful lot of voters have just sort of switched off from the internal Conservative dramas, and they're just thinking, oh, right, yeah, there's going to be a smoking ban. I wonder how that's going to work.
Rob Watson. Now to Denmark, and as we heard in the earlier podcast, one of Copenhagen's oldest buildings, its former stock exchange, has been engulfed by fire. It took firefighters hours on Tuesday to control the flames. Members of the public rushed to rescue some of the historic paintings inside. The fire has been compared to the one at Notre Dame in Paris 5 years ago, as the old stock exchange was in the middle of being renovated and its iconic spire collapsed into the scaffolding. The mayor of Copenhagen, Sophie Hestorp, said it was a sad day for Denmark.
It's terrible. It's terrible. I can't put into words what the stock exchange means for us as a building and a symbol for Copenhagen. The four dragons are a part of our skyline, and a lot of people from Copenhagen cycle past it or walk past it every day. The stock exchange is a part of their awareness, living in and around the area of the city. In that way, it's a 400-year-old cultural history that has been lost not only in Copenhagen, but also in Denmark.
Søren Larsen is a reporter for Denmark's national broadcaster, DR. He spoke to us from the scene.
They are still pouring water over the building. Like, two firefighters on each side are maybe in 20, 30 meters up with lifts, and they're still pouring water over the site with this building that once was and is not there anymore. The crowd is still being kept away because this is happening in the middle of Copenhagen, in the middle of the parliament of Copenhagen.
Do we have any idea what the cause was?
We don't know what the cause was yet, but what we know was that it was under construction and has been under reconstruction for more than a year, because this year the building was turning 400 years. And it was a historical site which was being restored. There was a party about to going on later on this year where they were like having a huge celebration of this building and what it has meant to Copenhagen. and to Denmark. The police haven't even been inside the building yet. The fire is still going on and the firefighters are still working. So we don't know actually what happened.
And it comes almost 5 years to the day since that awful fire at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, many people making comparisons between the two disasters.
Of course, it reminds us of what happened in Paris, because everyone in Denmark knows about this building. And I'm quite sure that every tourist who have been to Copenhagen, who have been on a guided tour, who have been sailing through the canals, they have seen this building, because this was one of the buildings we are very fond of, we are very proud of in Denmark. It means a lot. Everyone in Denmark knew this building and was, yeah, I don't know if they were proud of it, but they knew about it and knew about the historical meaning of Copenhagen. This was here, the trade in Denmark began. It is next to the Copenhagen harbor. Denmark is a nation surrounded by water, and it was here the trade out of and trade in of Copenhagen started, and that is what was burned down today.
Søren Larsen. France has long been revered as the home of haute cuisine.
Ah, Paris, France, home of the finest restaurants and the greatest chefs in the world. All my life, I've wanted to be one of them. You may think that's a strange dream for a rat.
In the 2007 film Ratatouille, Remy the Rat aspires to be a famous French chef, to ascend to what he and much of the world sees as the pinnacle of global gastronomy. But in the past couple of decades, the reality hasn't always lived up to the myth. France has been slipping down the league tables in international cooking contests and restaurant ratings. Now the French government has decided to swallow its pride and send up-and-coming young chefs abroad to pick up new ideas and techniques. I asked the Paris correspondent of the Times newspaper, David Chazan, why French cooking is no longer so revered as it once was.
Well, some French chefs appear to have grown a little bit complacent, have been resting on their laurels and haven't really kept pace with improving standards in other parts of the world, in Asia, in Scandinavia, also in Spain and Peru, for example. So there's a sense that France has remained at the same level while standards have been rising in the rest of the world, and perhaps that France has even declined. And at the same time, fast food has got a lot more popular in France, which is now McDonald's second biggest market after the US. Despite all of that, the notion that France is the world leader in food and wine is hardwired into the national DNA. So seeing other countries win the accolades, not France, is a severe blow to the nation's prestige and to its international influence. But this isn't just about soft power. It's also a question of hard cash, because France is one of the world's top tourist destinations, and visitors expect French food to live up to its reputation, so the government wants French chefs to up their game.
So, how is the government planning to restore French cuisine to its former eminence?
Well, it's reluctantly concluded that the only way to do it is to open up more to foreign influencers. So it's going to sponsor talented young chefs to go abroad, study what's happening in other countries, and bring the lessons back home. So the government's going to set up a new culinary academy that will sponsor exchange programs with training schools in other countries.
David Chazan. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.